All right, if you're anything like me, you hate running out of food on a trip. It's like a big fear. And so I'm a big fan of snacks during an adventure. And one of my absolute favorite go-to snacks are Wonderful Pistachios. You may be familiar with pistachios and the brand Wonderful Pistachios, but if you're not, they are one of the highest protein nuts out there. 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios is 6 grams of protein. That's 10% of your daily value. It also includes 9 essential amino acids, and they come with a ton of different flavors, varieties. There's a spicy version, there's lightly salted, there's no salted, there's so many. And every time I go on an adventure, I'm not even lying, I take an entire bag with me. And what's cool too, I love having the Wonderful Pistachio in shell, because then that almost gives me something to do and focus on as I'm paddling or biking through the really monotonous parts of the adventure. Every great adventure is going to have plenty of boring moments, and it's nice to have something to do and also something that is giving you some fuel, like Wonderful Pistachios. So they're one of my favorite adventure snacks, favorite road trip snacks, and definitely leave me feeling better than a lot of other snacks you can turn to. So if you want to learn more about how to fuel your next adventure with Wonderful Pistachios, go to WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hey folks, first off, apologies for getting the episode up late. Crazy weekend to say the least. I had to work, but my dog got injured, unfortunately, and I, you know, spent the weekend really caring for her in the beginning of this week, and then my kids are sick, and oh my gosh, I usually use the weekend time to work on Monday's episode, but that was not going to happen this weekend, so I'm getting it up late. And this is a really long episode. It's an unbelievable conversation with Craig Sawyer. And how I know Craig, which we don't get into until the very end of this episode, is that we met at the last Paddler Standing. If you remember me talking about that back in December, we have a 24-hour, basically a running clock adventure paddleboard race that goes around in this basically 5K loop around this lake until there's one person left standing. And it lasts like 50 hours. Well, Craig was one of those competitors. He dropped out and invited him, and he had helped to get a lot of video production set up before the race. So he was already helping with the IT stuff and getting stuff set up. And then, you know, we just started talking on camera because we're live streaming this whole race and I do commentary for it. And we quickly found out that Craig is like amazing at interviewing and at hosting and at just, you know, talking about the race. And he knows everybody and has so much experience. Great communicator. That's like, dang, dude, you're perfect for this. So we
We basically hung out for two straight days getting to know each other. And he had been, and we talked a little bit about it on the live stream, but I wanted to hear more on the podcast, which was the Yukon 1000 that he did on paddleboard. It is a race, technically a race, but you know, everybody's just trying to basically complete it. It's 1,000 miles on the Yukon River in the Yukon Territory and Alaska. And it is absolutely wild. And Craig and his good friend Skip, who by Craig's admission is much more experienced, much more talented, much more prepared for this kind of thing, they decided to do it on paddleboard. Like I said, it's 10 days, so 100 miles a day on paddleboard in some of the most remote areas of our continent. It was pretty wild. And as you'll hear, most of the adventure honestly happened beforehand with all the misadventures and everything that went on. But if you listen, really listen to just how unprepared and how unfit they seemed that like they were for this adventure, yet they went for it anyway and amazing things happened. And there's so many lessons in this story. It was such a pleasure to have Craig on. Craig is half this story. Skip, if you want to learn more about them, check out Surrey Hills Adventure Company and just Google that, Surrey, S-U-R-R-E. Surrey Hills Adventure Company, and you can learn if you're over in the UK, and you can learn more about going to their subclasses and meeting some of the folks and getting in with a community, because that's a huge theme in Craig's story is community and that finding that sense of community in paddleboarding. So I'm going to be joining Craig again to do the last Paddler Standing 2024 in December. If you're around, if you come down to Florida, Sarasota, come on and hang out. We'll have you on camera. We'll put you up on the live stream, interview you, and just have a great time. And lastly, Craig's day job is video production. So very naturally, he's a man of many talents, I will tell you. He's also making a documentary about this race and the experience and all the misadventure you're about to listen to. And if I know anything about how he creates and how meticulous he is, it's going to be a beautiful, incredibly well-done film. So be on the lookout for that, because the timing should be in the next few months, according to this conversation. And you can check out his website, above66.co.uk. For Surrey Hills Adventure Company, I think it's theshac.co.uk. All right, let's jump in. Craig Sawyer, I'm going to go ahead and welcome you to Adventure Sports Podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much, Mason. Lovely to be here.
I actually don't know this. Where are you coming from? I know you live in the UK, but I don't know where. Where are you at?
So I'm in the UK. It's the south coast of the UK. Normally, when I'm trying to explain where that is to people that aren't from the UK, it's like south of London. And if you hit the water, you've gone too far. So it's kind of like, it's between London and Brighton. I'm about 25 minutes from the coast, and about an hour from the capital.
Have you always been in that area? Did you grow up there? Where was home, or how'd you end up there?
So it's always been home. Born and bred in this area, bounced around the villages as I've grown up. But yeah, it's a perfect base as a growing up, but also as an adult as well. You know, you're near to the airport, so traveling is easy. The beach is 30 minutes, 20 minutes drive, but you can be in the city in an hour. It's, if you're going to live in the UK and if you put the weather aside, there's probably not many better places to live. There's lots of lovely places, but it's a very nice place to grow up and live.
I don't know any of this here. Did you grow up in a family that does kind of the adventures that you're doing, does some of the extreme things that we're going to talk about today, or is this kind of, are you kind of like the oddball?
I'm totally the oddball. there's literally zero adventure, sports, fitness in my family. And that's not to say my family aren't healthy, and you know, I don't want to sound like I'm knocking them, but no, I'm not going to start telling you stories of how I grew up as a kid spearfishing and climbing mountains, and you know, it's very different to that.
What got you into it? Like, I always want to know, how do you get into it? A lot of people, for me it was when I went off to school, but I did grow up camping with my parents and my dad, and there was some like foundational stuff, but it was made it my own once I kind of got out of the house. What was your trajectory?
So for the adventure ultra endurance stuff, nothing early. I mean, early on. I mean, my growing up, I was not really a sporty person. You know, I did sports, but there was nothing. You know, I had to give up football at age 11 because everyone else got really good at it. And you know,
That's pretty early to give it up.
Absolutely, I was quite bad. It kind of there was not really much there. But I do remember my mum brought me a gym membership for my 18th birthday. I remember that. And I remember, like, what the hell is what? Why have you brought me this? What are you trying to tell me? You know, I had my hair down to my waist. You know, I was wearing leather jackets and out listening to Metallica and Megadeth. And my mum brought me a gym membership. You know, I was probably the furthest from where you would expect to see someone in the gym. I went along and I really enjoyed it. So things like fitness, I'd say my 18th birthday was just from a fitness point of view, but it was very much, you know, in the gym, bro weights. And then as I made my way into my 20s, you know, that I kept it going. I always, fitness from 18 to now has always been just part of my day, as much as having lunch, having dinner, sleeping, the gym. You know, it's like my family know, my friends know that, you know, it's, I've always been that way. And I get bored with things, so I jumped around. You know, I'd be in the gym, and then I did kickboxing for like 3 years. And then I got into CrossFit, and but there was never any kind of adventure and ultra stuff. It was all just, you know, five times a week in the gym or kickboxing or that sort of stuff. But I guess the seeds of, I guess, paddling and adventure and ultra stuff started. I started kite surfing in my sort of mid-30s. Where we're based on the South Coast, we have a great scene. You know, we're very lucky with the kind of wind direction. We've got a lot of the world's best riders are based, you know, within a 10-mile radius of my house. So my love for kind of water started then, and being out of the water. I tore my MCL kite surfing.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, that story was crazy.
Yeah, so I tore my MCL kite surfing. And what that did is that introduced me to paddleboarding, because, you know, there's guys down the beach, paddleboards, didn't really get it. You know, I had actually seen it for the first time. I was out kite surfing in Barbados on a non-windy day. Brian Tarmer, 1980s windsurfing legend, had his Deaction hire shop on the beach. And we hired this really heavy Nash SUP because it was the thing we could play around in the waves. And even, I mean, I've got photos of me on that. So I've actually got a photo of my first ever time on a paddleboard. And it was in Barbados, holding a paddle the wrong way round, just trying to work out what this thing was. One of the things, you know, when you're so used to being on the water, you realize how much you miss being outside in the water. And I hadn't really thought about that until I tore my MCL. And kite surfing was no longer an option while I was in rehab. And so things that we don't really have swell down here, proper swell. You know, we have shore dump and lumps. So surfing wasn't going to work anyway. But someone was like, you know, paddleboarding is great. You know, you can get on the water and, you know, it's great all round. It's great for recovery and rehabilitation for the MCL, but it's also, can, you know, great cardio and fitness. And so that's where it cut the paddleboarding started. But even then, it was going out for half an hour, 45 minutes, you know, on a lake or a river or a very calm day on the English Riviera in the summer.
And that was because you were still recovering. Like you couldn't handle anything more than that, really.
It's weird because it was sometime, but in my mind as well, it wasn't because I thought I wanted to do more, but I couldn't as well. I was just doing what felt good for recovery. Mm-hmm. You know, I was back in the gym doing what I could and getting out. Just basically, it was an opportunity to get out in the fresh air, get out in the sea air. But it wasn't a case of, oh, I could go further or longer once my leg gets better. It was more like, okay, that's cool. So again, it's a weird one. It didn't really, again, grab me like, say, something like kite surfing did when I first started.
When was this, by the way? How long ago?
2017, so 6 years ago.
So not crazy long ago. I mean, you're just so known for it now. And it's crazy, isn't it? Like, that is something we've heard about on this show a lot, is like how injury, you think you've found the thing you've loved, and one of the themes is like, it almost finding what you love early on prevents you from discovering new things later in life until you have an injury or something that literally prevents you from doing that thing. And then you find this other, it's crazy how some of us get pigeonholed so early on, and then something like this has to force us to discover something else.
And what I think is really exciting about that, having now seen that process happen, is I'm actually really excited about what else I might soon discover.
Yeah, I mean, just you're excited for your next major injury, you know? Yeah. That's exciting.
Well, I maybe not put it in those words. but the point is, we don't know, you know, I'll keep doing it while I love it until I don't, and I'll mm-hmm. find something else, and something else will take over, and so on. I think that's really important. If anything to do with physical fitness and the outdoors and the benefits, you know, you find these new things and you embrace it, you learn a new skill, you push yourself, you go back to the bottom of the ladder. There's so many great things about learning something new. But yeah, it was relatively recent, you know, 2017, and it kind of, you know, the injury got better. I started getting back together again. I kind of, the thought of going back kite surfing was still not there. You know, whilst the knee was repairing, I was fully aware it wasn't going to be the strongest. I mean, you look at most beaches and the kite surfers, you all see them going out with braces on and all sorts. You know, and I didn't want to be that guy that was the older I got, the more I looked like RoboCop. So the paddleboarding kept going. I brought a surf sup, even though we have no surf down here, because it looked cool. And then where did it go from there? I do remember seeing online, we have a race or a series called Sup Bike Run, which is kind of like a twist on a normal triathlon. So rather than, you know, so you basically, it was a triathlon series in the UK where you got sup, you've got mountain biking, and you've got trail running. So that's the kind of, and you know, and at the time there was maybe three or four events in the year, and I saw it advertised on Facebook, I think, and I thought, oh, that is quite interesting. You know, I've got a sup, I can, you know, it was like a 2K, I think the long distance was like 2K sup, then there was like a 35 kilometer mountain bike in Wales, a bit hilly, and then it was a 10K trail run to finish with. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, that's interesting. I signed up for it. And you know, the whole kind of sliding doors moment, the whole kind of, when you look back on moments in your life and you think, what would have happened, or what did that decision of going to that race start? It's pretty mental, kind of like the dominoes that fell from that led to where I am now. So effectively, I went to this race in Wales on my own in my camper van, didn't know anyone, mountain bike strapped to the back, and went there the night before so you could camp over at the site. And I, you know, met a few other people in the car park. It was a, you know, proper like car park campsite. And everyone was like, oh, well, you know, there's a nice country pub about, you know, 10 minutes cycle up the road. We're all going to go up there. Do you fancy joining us? And at Stuart's Hill, yeah, got on the mountain bike and we all wobbled our way up to the pub and started drinking like athletes do, you know, beer and all the things that, you know, we probably shouldn't do the day before or the night before. And there was probably 20, 30 of us up at this country pub in the beer garden. And I could have sat on any one of probably many tables and chairs in that garden and talked to any one of those people, you know. And I just happened to sit next to a guy called Skip. I couldn't tell you why. There was probably just a spare seat. Sat next to him, got chatting to him. And, you know, and it turned out, you know, through chatting that we actually lived very close together. We, you know, to put into context, this race was probably about a 4-hour drive from where I live. So mm-hmm. I know in the US that's probably next door, but you know, for us in the UK,
that's a decent drive. Yeah. That's a decent drive. Yeah, that's a nice morning commute.
Yeah, exactly. And it turned out that, you know, Skip lived 20, 30 minutes away from where I lived, and he had a lake and he had a paddleboard club. He did mountain bike guiding and instruction in the Surrey Hills. He had a lake where he was just starting his business, the Shack, the Surrey Hills Adventure Company. And I thought, wow, this is great. And he's like, no, you should come, you know, when we get back, you know, in the next few weeks, come down, you know, come down, say hi, have a look at the spot and see if you want to come paddleboarding. You know, we've got a nice little small crew that go out on the lake. So that was the start of a chain of events. The actual race itself was inconsequential. I mean, I think the 2K paddle I did on my SUP surfboard across a lake, you know, like I think from memory, if you look at my GPS track, it looked like I was probably still drunk because it was it wasn't a straight line. But I will continue to blame the surfboard. Yeah, did the event, drove home, and a few days later, thought, you know, I'll give Skip a call and let me pop along and see what this place is like. And with this amazing little location we've got, it's a, you know, a nice big sand quarry that's filled in. It's a huge lake, very beautiful. It took 20 minutes from my house. Met Skip and more of the crew, as it were, from the area, all lovely people. And, you know, still paddleboarding wasn't really it was growing, but as it still is, but, you know, it was hodgepodge of kit and boards and paddles and people of all different levels and abilities just out, you know, paddling. And that's kind of like where I think it started becoming more of an interesting thing to do, because I found a community. And I think with anything like sport, you know, when you can combine a sport that you have an interest in or something that's good for you, and you add that community layer, mm-hmm. I think that's when the magic starts to happen.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. With any adventure, hydration is very important. I've been on so many trips where I've been dehydrated or couldn't stay hydrated enough, and Element helps anyone, including especially adventurers, stay hydrated. Without the sugar and other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks, you don't want to have cramps and headaches and fatigue and brain fog or weakness on trips, whether that's training or out on the adventure itself. And having the ability to have something like Element there is so important. Element is a zero-sugar electrolyte drink mix free of all the sugar and artificial coloring. Element was developed by former research biochemist Rob Wolf, 2 times New York Times bestselling author and one of the Navy SEAL Resiliency Committee members for over a decade. From Olympic athletes to special forces to health experts to business leaders to everyday health, Element is their go-to choice for hydration. Our listeners can receive a free Element sample pack with any order when you go to drinkelement.com/adventuresports. That's drinkelement.com/adventuresports. And you can try Element totally risk-free. If you don't like it, give it away to a friend and they'll give you your money back, no questions asked. I've been using it on rides and paddles lately and I'm really enjoying it. Element, stay salty.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
So what did you feel like you got out of paddleboarding that you maybe didn't get out of some of the other things you were doing? Because it is it's a slow pace, you know what I mean? It's hiking on the water. You're just going at the speed of walking, more or less.
I think initially for me, what made it was the community, was getting out of people and not feeling like you are, like if you go to the gym, if you go out for a run, it's a very conscious thing you're doing, and you're always aware that you're pushing yourself at the time. Whereas with something like paddleboarding, at the time you could get lost in the moment, you know, you could just be in some amazing locations, and I realized just how beautiful our country was and how much access to waterways we had. And so that was, you know, the community, the being out in the fresh air, being active without necessarily feeling like you're active. And it worked really well with my recovery and my rehab. It worked really well with, it complemented the gym. You know, I was in the gym lifting heavy weights, and then my zone 2 cardio type stuff was done in fresh air. And, you know, I love challenges. I'm a very competitive person. And, you know, we started doing night paddles at the lake, and I love that. You know, like people, how can you paddling in the winter? Oh, it's dark. Why, you know, don't we stop now? And I was like, no, why would you? You know, so seeds were starting to be planted there. And I think it's because of the whole diversity. It was only every time you looked, there was something new to try and discover.
You meet this guy Skip and you get in this community, and then all of a sudden, I don't know where along the lines y'all had this absolutely crazy idea of paddleboarding 1,000 miles in Alaska and the Yukon Territory. Take me through kind of the stepping stones of that, because you jump over a few stones, in my opinion.
I mean, it sounds like the
because the way you're talking, it's like, yeah, I'm mellowing it out, but then all of a sudden you ramp it up to one of the craziest adventures I've ever heard.
So I found the community of paddling, and we had a UK club sup series. It was a sup. It was a race at Bray Lake in the UK, where you could go to this lake and clubs would compete with each other, get points to win, you know, prizes for their club. And Skip's like, yeah, you know, we should do this. Do you fancy being the team manager? You're great organizing. You love all the organizing and logistics. You know, so I kind of thought, yeah, great, this looks quite interesting. So pulled together a team and we went to this race. And I thought, oh, God, you can do racing. This is quite interesting. Oh, that guy's boards, they're interesting. I've not seen some of these, you know. And there's me racing around on a surf. So I entered the Surf's Up race. So it's a flat water lake. And there's like, I think there's like six of us like wibbling around on Surf's Ups, trying to outdo each other, being overtaken by these 14-foot race boards. But I kind of like, well, this is quite interesting. You can race and I'm competitive. This is, you know, so you start thinking, oh, this is, what else can we do? And where else can we go with this? And I honestly think there's probably a few stages that I'm going to jump over, but it happened very quickly. But Skip and I, we'd gone out for a paddle together on one of the local canals, an hour paddle, finishing at a country pub, generally was the pattern, which maybe is why we liked it. I remember we were at this country pub and we were talking about the racing and what, you know, we could maybe go and try next year. And this is in 2019 now. So there was a couple of years me doing it. So a couple of years spent doing not very much. And I think we were like, wouldn't it be really cool to do a multi-day, some kind of adventure race, something that, or something, you know, an expedition. And to put into context, I have zero bushcraft, zero camping, zero outdoors experience. I mean, I was in the Cubs when I was like six, and I was in the Air Cadets in the UK. So I think I'd slept under a hammock twice and smelt of a smoky fire once. That's my level. But Skip, to put it, was very different. So Skip, you know, ran a bushcraft company, an outdoors activity center. So I think, you know, he was an outdoors person. You know, he loves the outdoors. He lives and breathes the outdoors. He was a scout leader at the time. His whole background and youth was scout. So he had that side. So I think he probably led the conversation unknowingly to like, oh, you know, we could do some outdoor adventures. You know, we could maybe look at some overnighters. Maybe we start looking, because there's not long waterways in the UK necessarily. It's tidal in places, and there's not many places you can go for a multi-day like you can in the US or Canada. So I think there was some kind of Google searching of like, what can we do? Where's a place where we can go do a multi-day? And I just remember, and I know looking back, you try to remember how it was and not change the story, but something popped up. It was the Yukon River Quest. And for the listeners, I'm sure many of your listeners, it's in the Yukon. It's a 715 kilometers race from Whitehorse to Dawson in the Yukon. It's a supported race. It's, you know, but it's a grueling race for canoes, kayaks, Voyager canoes, and paddleboards. And that popped up, and what the hell's that? Look, 715 kilometers. Well, that's not for us, is it? You know, we've just gone out and done 3 kilometers to the pub, and that was hard enough. And I just remember the tagline on the website. It may still be the tagline now. It says it like the second longest paddle race in the world. You know, if this was a video chat and you could see what my eyes just glinted, and I remember just being like, well, that's the second longest, you know, what's the longest? So, you know, Google, you know, longest paddleboard race in the world. Well, it wasn't paddleboard, paddle race. They could have, it was not for SUPs. It was, you know, just paddle race. And there popped up the Yukon 1000, you know, 1,000 miles. So that's miles. So that's 1600 kilometers, unsupported paddle survival race from the Yukon Whitehorse, but past Dawson into the Arctic Circle, crossing into Alaska, finishing it only the second bridge in 1,000 miles. By the bridge is only there to support the Alaskan pipeline. And we're like, oh, this is interesting. Look at that. You know, not as an interesting, let's do it. Interesting as in like, who the hell does these kind of things? The conversation slipped from let's look at something we can do to let's just Google out, you know, the rabbit hole of Google, as I know we've all go down. You know, you start on one thing and you wonder how you got somewhere. But also there was a little bit that said applications for 2020 now open. And this is the summer of 2019, as legend has it. We sat in the pub and we thought, should we apply? And I think there was probably a bit of beer bravado.
Liquid courage, as we call it.
Liquid courage. Yeah, liquid, absolutely. I think we both went home our separate ways. Because it's like a form, it's quite a detailed form from memory you have to fill in. And it was like, you know, like your name, what's your experience? What's your background? You know, why should we, you know, what have you done? What would you do to kind of make sure that you could complete this race? There's all this stuff. And I was just like, so Skip probably went off and did his, and you know, he's, you know, scout leader for 20, 30 years, runs an outdoor bushcraft company, you know, like hasn't done anything really like ultra endurance. And I think at the time he may have crawled a marathon, and he actually went for the world record for walking backwards when he was in his late teens. It's quite a funny story. It's a separate story. But I remember sitting there filling this form in and like, I've done nothing. I thought, I think I may have even joked, you know, I was in the scout, I was in the Cubs when I was younger. I honestly, I think I said the biggest ultra, the biggest kind of push I've done is a half marathon. But I think what I did was something obviously did stir inside me, because there's a bit where you put what you would do if you were accepted for the race. What would you? And I think I put a very sincere, like, you know, if I was accepted for this race, you know, the next 9 months I would spend cross-skilling, skilling up, learning, studying, doing everything I needed. You know, I would not, you know, along the lines of, I would never put myself in a position where I would let down my partner on such a race, or let down my family and friends. So I would do whatever it took. And I'm a very determined person in all walks of life to do something once I set my mind. It was something along those lines, to paraphrase. And I mean, I think they said that they had over 2,000 applications that year for 40 slots, that 4-0, of which at the time there was only 5 of those were for paddleboard teams. And we sent the forms off, and to be honest, forgot all about it. Just like, I think I didn't even tell my family or anything. I didn't say anything. I was like, you know, kind of forgot about it, and went on a summer holiday a couple of weeks later, and laying by the pool at, you know, quarter to midday with a beer in hand, and just got a text message through, or I think it was an email through. I had my Apple Watch on, so you could see a preview. I always remember this, and kind of looked at my watch, and I just saw there was enough of the preview that just said UConn race decision, and it just said accepted. And I can remember, like, it felt like my whole life had been kind of like, you know, it was just, I didn't know the kind of like what that really meant. And obviously we could have said no, it wasn't like we were committed to anything, but it was just a moment of sheer panic and also strange endorphin excitement. It's amazing how your body can produce all these kind of chemical reactions to natural things. And it was, I remember it being an amazing just feeling of like terror mixed in with jubilation, just from seeing those three lines on a Apple Watch screen.
I gotta ask this: what did your family think when you said I want to do this, and I'm accepted?
Well, as most blokes do, we played it down and made out that it was just I'd be honest, Mason, as well. I didn't even know really where the UConn was.
I'm sure most Canadians don't know.
I knew that it was in a Canada area. And I remember the promo video that they had talked about, like, the risk of life and death and people will die. So I thought, I best not show them that. That's probably not the best way. So I think it probably over dinner, I just kind of like, you know, in the small talk, was like, oh, you know, Skip and I might go and do a race next year in Canada. And, you know, do you mind? I might be away for I haven't worked out the details yet. Yeah, I'll be honest, it was definitely a play it down. Skip and I had a quick call and we were like, look, do we actually really want to do this? We can back out now. There's no, you know, we're not going to lose face. No one knows. You know, we're not, you know, we've not gone out telling everyone we're applying and then turning it down. So we told the organizers, look, can you give us like a few weeks? Give us a few weeks to come back to you. You know, we've got to work out money, family. You know, I joke about it, but I did have to think about friends and family, work, what was really involved. Had I really understood the gravity of the event and what it would mean? So, and Skipper and I did spend a lot of time talking. So we kind of put the acceptance on the back burner. I probably did play it down with the family. I certainly didn't share too much with them because, you know, I didn't want them over worrying while I was trying to work through something in my own head. You know, I thought, mm-hmm, I'd deal with that side once I'm sorted. I'll then, this is just, we knew nothing about the race, the area, the region, nothing. So I was like, right. So I got my super calculator out and was like, right, you've got to do 1,000 miles. You've got to do it in a 10-day cutoff. So for those of you that don't know about the UConn 1000, I mean, it is a 1,000-mile race. It is only goes past one or two main settlements. It's unsupported. So everything you need for survival goes with you. There's no resupplies. There's no safety boats. There's no one out in the river. You can have no external help. So there's no external communications. You know, you can't have any two-way. You have a sat phone in a tamper-proof bag that is there for you to basically call for rescue. When you break that tamper-proof bag, you are out of the race.
Really?
Yep, absolutely. Wow. So unless there's a very good reason, like you might have helped another, you might be helping another team, or you might have a very serious, you are allowed no outside help. You see nobody. There's no one that lives up there. It's just trapped around, you know, it's just all bears, you know, it's bear country. And
grizzly bears too.
Grizzly bears, you know, and obviously being in the UK, the biggest thing I have to worry about is rabbits and squirrels. So, you know, so I park the wildlife for a second, but, you know, so in my head, I'm like, right. And the important thing is there's a 10-day cutoff. You know, if you don't finish it within 10 days, the organizers leave the finish line. When you get there, no one's there waiting for you. And you beg a passing trucker, you hope, to take you to the nearest town. So you're like, right, 10 days, 1,000 miles. Oh, well, that's the other thing. Like you can paddle up to 18 hours a day. So you have to have, there's a mandatory 6-hour stop, and you can choose when you take that, as long as it's between the hours of, you can, between 10 o'clock at night and midnight, you can start your 6-hour mandatory stop. And, you know, so the reason there's a window is you're not always going to find a safe place to stop. So yeah, around 10:30 at night, you start looking for a place to camp. And then once you stop, you make sure it's safe, and then you start your 6 hours. So, you know, in my head, you're like, right, 10 days, 18 hours, 180 hours of paddling, it's 1,000 miles, do the calculations. That's what our average kilometer or miles per hour needs to be. You know, that, so that's how we did it. We weren't that cool. And I can't remember what it was. It was something like, I mean, 7.5 kilometers an hour. At this point, I had no idea what that meant, because I didn't do any racing. So I had, that number was arbitrary to me at the time. So we met on our local canal we thought, let's go and do a training paddle, see how close we get to that, and work out whether it's realistic that we could train ourselves to, if we're not on it, you know. So we went in the summer to this canal, and like, I've got photos and video, and like, I'm wearing some board shorts. It was pouring of rain, but it was warm. I've got board shorts, a ski jacket, ski gloves, and it went terrible. I think we averaged maybe 4.5 kilometers an hour.
And were you working to get that? Like you were trying, right?
I was dehydrated, so I cramped up massively. We paddled for maybe 3.5 hours. I had stomach cramp. I think Skip at one point, when we finished paddling, he had to lift my board out of the water. I had that whole claw cramp of the hands. My core was cramping. I think at one point he nearly had to get me undressed because I couldn't lean down to get my socks off. And we've got it all this on camera. It's hilarious. And like, you would think, as all sane people would at that moment say, nah, this ain't for us. You know, this is, you know, that was fun. But like, the complete opposite happened. And we were just both like, we've got a benchmark of where we are at now. You know, everyone needs a starting point. You know, we know where we're at. We know kind of like, we've got some time to work on it. And we, the next day, we said, yes, yeah, count us in, we're in. I think I remember cramp stopped, got in the car, drove back. And there was just something, I think there was something about the race. There was something about anticipation of what we were about to try and the journey we were about to go on that was just overwhelming the common sense of, you guys are not right for this. You know, like, this is not your bag. Go and do a few other races first. Don't go for the longest paddle race in the world as your first attempt at doing anything beyond a half marathon run.
Man, I love it. I absolutely love it. It is so wild out there. I mean, the Yukon, and then go from there to literally the Arctic Circle in Alaska. There's very few places on Earth as wild as that, or as remote as that, and as frankly dangerous. Was some of the logic too, like, okay, the river will be moving pretty quick to help us make up that time? Was that being calculated too? Did you have any idea what that would be?
So this is great. So when we did the training paddle, we didn't know the river had much flow.
Okay.
So when we did 4.5 kilometers an hour, we thought, we're going to have to really sort this out and work out it. So, you know, how would we find an extra 3 kilometers an hour and do that for 10 days with all the gear? But then what we did is, obviously, once we said yes, we obviously reached out to previous racers and started doing a lot more online research. And back then, I think paddleboards had only done it. There's only about 6 people that had done it on paddleboards at the time, I think. And it was Bart Zavart, who had done it in 2018. We Skip had a contact with him, and he was the first person that was like, look, you know, the river's got flow, you know, it changes throughout, but it's got flow. Sometimes the wind will be in your face and you'll feel like you're standing still, but you know, you are moving. And his bit, I always remember, I've got his email still, and he was just like, if you stay on the water for 18 hours a day and do not come off for any reason whatsoever, you could, it's achievable. You know, you've just got to just keep doing it. So when you start looking at the flow, I mean, there's not always flow, and depending on what the river levels are each year, it changes. But there was this amazing few months of discovery of a region I'd never heard of a few months beforehand. The other thing is you have to make your own maps. No maps exist for the region because the ice melt means that it changes every year. You have to make your own maps. You're ordering these hand-drawn maps that were drawn in the 80s, and they come over to you on this like ring-bound book from a bookstore in Yukon, is the only place you can get them from. And you're, and it's like hand-drawn scribbles. And then you're combining that with Google Earth stuff, which half of it, the Google satellite, obviously went over in the winter. So it's just white. The more, particularly me, I think, because I've got that kind of analytical, I love that whole kind of research planning. I start reading every book you've got under the sun that had the word Yukon in it. And I would just report back, I'd just bite-size it for Skip. You know, I'd spend days and days and then be like, okay, Skip, here's a bullet point list of things you need to know. He, you know, his skills were going to come in first aid, the bushcraft, the survival side of things. So yeah, so there was a, you know, a big, and we started going out for longer paddles. We got some sponsors on to for kits. We got some better boards. And you know, within a few months, we were going out doing, you know, sort of 7, 8, 9 hour paddles, and really only stopping because the rivers around here had no more distance on them. You know, we were hitting, we were done, and they're tidal, so you couldn't go up and down them. So by Christmas 2019, like, you know, we turned from 45 minute cramping, 4 kilometer an hour, nobody's in ski gear, to going out and doing respectable 7, 8 hour paddles with a little bit knowledge about the rivers and some of the things we might have to deal with.
In preparation, what were some of your biggest fears?
So the overarching one was, I can't remember where I read it somewhere, the race organizer, John, was always, I can't remember where he said it or something, but it was like, it was real risk to life. You know, there is real risk to life. You know, he's an army guy. A lot of ex-military or serving military do this race. They are very used to working in an environment where there's risk to life. It's part of their day job. Like this. So, but for a guy that lives on the South Coast, the worst he's done is tore his MCL and had someone patch him up. And you know, the thought of someone having to sign, when you're signing documents where it's just matter of fact, the risk to life, who's your next kid, how do you, you know, what do we do? You know, your sat phone is basically for repatriation if your mate gets killed. When something like that, you know, it's like, again, it's a strange, also excitement, because half is like, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? I don't need to do this. I'm not doing this to prove anything. But the other half is like, this is pretty cool, isn't it? This is great. So I think the biggest fears were just the overarching risk to life, making sure that I was comfortable, that I understood those risks. You know, I'm not stupid. I wasn't going to chuck myself into something that was going to end in me ending. But I also don't come from a background where I could necessarily truly understand what I was letting myself in for. So I think that was the overarching risk for me. And then the wildlife was a big thing. Again, we don't really have to deal with wildlife in the UK. You know, we don't have grizzly bears, wolves, you know, all these things. And you can, of course, you try to read about them to learn, but of course, what you hear is bad stuff. So you start to try and keep a very practical head on yourself and understand that actually, you know, it's a beautiful place to go, and it's amazing to have the opportunity to see, you know, one of the Earth's final frontiers. But with that comes, you know, there is no safety blanket. There's no one going to pull you out, particularly once you go past the halfway point. Dawson, you can pull out of Dawson, the halfway spot where the River Quest ends. It's got an airport. There's buses back to Whitehorse. To that point, you've not seen anything. Once you get to Dawson, I think there's about 1,000 people that live there or something in the summer. But like, you can get to Dawson and you can be like, do you know what? This is not for us. And you could just happily pull out. But once you go past Dawson, there is no way out other than the finish line or a bush plane or a helicopter when an emergency action plan gets put into place. And that's only going to happen because you or your mates died or had some serious injury or something's gone very badly wrong. And I think that the fear there is like you have to war game everything. You know, you have to think, there's no point in pretending that stuff can't go wrong. You know, there's no point in blinking and closing your eyes, you have to say, well, okay, what are the potential risks? And then what can we do to either mitigate them? Well, mitigate obviously is primary. What can we do to avoid that happening? But then also, what can we do if that does happen? You know, like, what would we do? And I think it's a very humbling thing, but also these are incredible life skills dealing with stress. You know, we went on an amazing 4-day advanced bushcraft survival, more like it was REC level 4, which is like rescue and emergency care. And it's like a 4-day real practical, like, this is not the kind of like St. John's Ambulance first aid at work. John got his hand stuck in the photocopier kind of stuff. This is like, you and your mate have had a fight with a bear. He's got blood pumping out of his arteries and you haven't. How are you going to deal with it? It was that kind of stuff, you know. And it was amazing because you're doing this stuff and you're thinking, wow, I'm learning all these, you know, and this race never happened, or I never make it. I've still learned all this amazingly cool stuff. So I know that was a bit of a long-winded answer, but I think the biggest fears were, you know, just the risk to life of things that we had no idea what that could be. And things like wildlife is obviously a big one for anyone that's not perhaps an outdoor Canadian or American. We looked at guns. This is quite funny. We were saying, Skits, should we get a gun? in the air cadets, I used to shoot guns, Skip, you know, in a shooting range. You know, let's get. And I was like, so I even started Googling, like, doing a gun license in the UK to be able to buy a gun. And, you know, and then you're like, I think it was probably John, the organizer, was like, we're probably going to be more of a risk to each other if we've got a gun floating around between us. And then you're crossing a border with a gun. It's an unmanned border. So you've basically then got illegal firearms, and so you're ditching guns. And it's just like, and what you're going to do, you're going to shoot the bear and piss him off. So, you know, you're going for these things like, you know, do I need a gun and all that stuff? So it was, yeah, it was a really, everything we looked at made me more excited and nervous at the same time. But there's just something that just kept us in it.
I can't stress just how crazy this seems, man. And I know that was probably settling in. Was there a moment early on that was like a welcome to Yukon moment, or welcome to the last frontier, where it was like, okay, this is what we've gotten ourselves into?
We'd be here for 4 days if I went through exactly what happened from that moment. But I'm going to really try and condense this into a very quick thing. So come March 2020, the race was in July 2020. At this point, we've got kit. We've started booking flights. Our fitness levels are up. You know, we'd learned a lot. The mapping was done. Kind of like, it was getting really real. And we're really like, okay, no, I had this confidence starting to build in. Well, both of us had this confidence building. And I said, you know, why couldn't two guys from the UK go and do this? You know, and we're on the right trajectory. And then, of course, what happened in 2020 happened. World come to a stop. Obviously, the race was cancelled in 2020. And that was an interesting time because, you know, you've been building up, and then it was pulled away from us. But we kept training. And we were like, you know, because at the time, you know, this was going to be a 3 or 4 week blip in the world, and pretty much soon knew that 2020 wasn't going to happen. But 2021, yeah, okay, we've got an extra year to train. I think we made a little video and we're like, okay, cool, you know, it is what it is, you know, we've got another 12 months. And then December 2020, I think the race organizers were like, 2021's cancelled as well. You know, the world's not really opening up. Travel's still difficult anyway. And, you know, you guys are traveling to a part of the world that's not had this virus. It's not, you know, it's like, it's just not going to happen. And that was really hard, particularly for Skip, because, you know, it's very draining on your mindset. Obviously, with what else is going on in the world, you're trying to keep your businesses going. You know, you've got family and loved ones that are getting ill, and it's a very unsettling time. And you've got this thing that you were so excited for that keeps getting put on the back burner. And again, we could have pulled out. We could have pulled out in summer of 2019 when I cramped up after half an hour and eating half banana. We could have pulled out in March 2020 when COVID hit and the race was postponed. We could have pulled out in 2021 when the race was postponed again and things were really starting to take their toll on us. We could have, but we didn't. We got to 2022, and the race was on. You know, it's happening. The world's starting to open up. You know, there was still things we had to consider around traveling with COVID and bits and pieces. But so in answer to your question, was there a moment? There was, because we got on a flight and we flew out with all our gear to Whitehorse. in the summer of 2022, and it was happening. You know, it was like, this is really it. And I remember I'd spent 3 years studying maps. I had, whether you're not, you've heard of Parkinson's law, you know, the human ability to fill the amount of time you've got to do a task. So if I say you've got 6 months to prepare for the Yukon 1000, you will take 5 months, 3 weeks and 6 days to do it. If I say you've got 5 years to prepare for the Yukon 1000, you will take 4 years, 11 months and 30 days to do exactly the same. You know, we have an amazing ability to fill time. I felt I knew that river before I'd even seen it, because I'd studied maps. I'd been, you know, it felt like something, like I felt close to it. I felt like I knew where I was going, having never set foot in the Yukon. And I remember flying, you know, flying over in a smaller plane over the Yukon for the first time, seeing the river out the window. I was like, wow, look at that. And look how vast this space is. And I remember we landed in Whitehorse and a few days before the race, and it was midnight and the sun was up, you know, and we walked down to the river and we saw the river for the very first time. And I couldn't tell you what it felt like to see it. And the tough thing that year was it was a high water year. It was one of the second year in a row they had a 1-in-100-year flood. So that river was moving. You've never seen it move. It was like light speed. It was the most scary, powerful show of raw emotion. And we were both like, we've never been on water that fast.
Yeah, I'm sure it was freezing cold.
We just looked at it from the bank and got bitten by mosquitoes the size of aircraft. It was like, wow.
What were you thinking? Like, what did we just sign up for?
I think honestly, in hindsight, we both admit to each other, we were thinking the F word. We were like, no, we didn't say it to each other, but I think you can see on our faces
that like we're about to willingly stand on that water for 1,000 miles, 1,000 miles.
With no help, no backup, no support.
Yeah,
no safety,
and only getting farther away from all that, from help and backup and support.
And some of you, if any of your listeners are still listening to me at this point, will say, well, hang on a second, you said 2022, but it's now 2024. So what happened? And well, basically, we spent a couple of days before the race running around the stores, department stores, buying all the stuff we didn't need. That's the other thing you do. You bump into loads of other races in the shops. You know, we're all going into department stores, buying stuff you can't fly with and buying kit you probably don't need. I started feeling a little bit rough, putting it down to travel. But it felt like I'd been sucker punched. My arms were heavy. My legs were heavy. Kept on putting it down to stress and the worry of the race. And to cut an exceedingly annoyingly long story short, the day before the race, I did a test and I had COVID. I'd never had COVID before. I'd never had COVID since. And I got it for the first and only time the day before the race start in 2022. And I had it bad. I mean, I couldn't move. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it was like I was in bed with sweats. And this was also a time when it was still not really socially acceptable. There's still people that didn't want travel to open up. So it was not like, you know, and the biggest thing was we were about to go to a part of the world where this has not gone. You know, there are small communities. There are, you know, that's why we didn't go for 2 years, you know. And I had to make a decision. I wasn't going to put other people at risk by taking something 1,000 miles up the river or risk, you know, skip getting it as well, you know, 2 days into the race. Or so we scratched, we pulled out. I could hear the river from my hotel room. You know, I could see it. I had all my gear there, you know. And yeah.
So did you have to quarantine right there?
Technically, well, obviously I couldn't fly because it was like a £5 million fine if you were flying. So I didn't fly. There were quarantine hotels still in Canada at the time. So we kept on the QT. Skip got his own room in the hotel. I stayed in the hotel room on my own. He would like deliver packages to my door, knock and run. And I spent like 4 days in the hotel. And then there's a whole long story about things happen for a reason. No, not happen for a reason, but like, you can always find the good in something. There's always, don't get me wrong, it was the most horrific time, you know, for Skip. I mean, like, I was ill. I was in bed sweating. He had to walk around and see everyone, went and saw everyone leave the start line, you know. He had to go through all that. He had a tougher time than I did. You know, I was getting the sympathy from back home, you know, and getting the parcel deliveries from him outside my door.
Yeah.
Skip has a habit of making friends just like we did on that bench in the pub garden in 2017. He got talking to one of the canoe teams Glenn and Maureen from Ontario, mm-hmm. absolutely legends, doing it in a canoe. And they were like, he's a First Nation, they're First Nations. He was like, hey, you know, we've got a truck. Fancy getting it to the finish line to meet us because we haven't quite worked out how we're going to get it there yet. So we went on an adventure 4 or 5 days after the race start. We were like, look, I've still got it, but I'm feeling better. We're not going to go into any, we're not going to see people. We're not going to hotel. You know, there's no hotel. You know, we've got all our camping gear. We've got all our food. You know, we're going to go in this truck, all kitted out for, you know, the roads in that part. There's only two roads, basically. One goes left and one goes right. And the potholes the size of, you know, it's, but this truck was designed for those roads. And we spent 7-8 days in the Yukon and Alaska, so meandering our way up the road that only goes near the river twice. So it's not like you're following the race, but yeah. You're, and we got to the finish line and we had an adventure. We got to see Alaska. We got to paddle on, we found some lakes, random lakes, and we would stop the car. We had the boards pumped up on the roof. I mean, I could hardly, I was paddling like 300-400 meters. I was out of breath. I was, everything hurt, but I just wanted to get on the water. We got used to camping in the wild, in bear country, and just getting a feel for that. And we got to the finish line and we watched and we waited for every single team to come in. And that was the hardest thing and the best thing we've ever done. You know, we could have easily have not and gone home, but we stayed there and we watched everyone come in. And I remember we hadn't even talked about whether we'd go back in 2023. It was just like, it was this kind of cloud in our heads of like, what's going to happen? And anyway, we, at the finish line, I made a promise to myself that like I was going to be back at that finish line, but I would only get there by the water. I picked up a random stone off the finish line beach and stuck it in my pocket, and I put it back there this year.
I did not know that. I knew that it was canceled due to COVID. I didn't know you went, got COVID, yeah. and then just basically stayed in the backcountry until you got better. Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that helped make this show possible.
Are you looking to sell anything at all online? Well, I would advise you to look into Shopify. They are a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. I use Shopify every day at my day job. It has been with us since our company was a tiny little team all the way up to where we are today, one of the biggest breweries in the country. Whether you're auctioning off autographed apparel, selling sleek skis, or selling non-alcoholic beer like we are at Athletic Brewing, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their personal POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. We manage a podcast, a blog, all that right there on our Shopify store. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and has extensive help resources whenever you're dealing with an obstacle. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ASP, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ASP for Adventure Sports Podcast now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ASP. This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's cowboy boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and the friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, that's fine. Just go to tecovas.com. That's tecovas.com. They offer free shipping on all boots as well as free returns and exchanges. They ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today and get ready for this summer. If you ever thought, can I pull off a pair of cowboy boots? Then you should pull on a pair of Tecovas and you'll see. They'll become your new favorite footwear. Cowboys knew what they were doing when they invented this Western wear.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
So anyone that's keeping track, that's another good reason why we could have pulled out, but we didn't. So that's about five different times.
Gosh, yeah, it's almost like out of taking the sign at this point. Like, yeah. It is.
I mean, there is that. And like, also, it was an ultra endurance event, just getting to the damn race, and that may be enough for someone. So, yeah,
just getting to it's hard enough. Apparently, I mean, y'all could got there and then had setbacks, so that's really cool. What did you think about Alaska? Because you got to go a lot more places than you would have otherwise.
Wow, you know, like chicken. Look up chicken.
Yes, oh, what? I know all about chicken. Yeah,
yeah. Like, what, three people live there in the winter, yeah. And like 20 in the summer, and like there's a row of shop fronts, and like. You don't realize, but there's basically, you go into this souvenir shop and ring a bell and the lady serves you. Then you go next door and you ring a bell and the same lady runs around the back and comes in and serves you. We went to Dawson and we did the Sourtoe, you know, we did, you know, those things. And we saw the river. We went to Five Finger Rapids. You know, we saw the rapids. We saw parts of the river where we could. So what that did, I like to think we're both very positive people. And no matter how hard that was, what we did do is confirm that our planning and our prep was on point. Everything we had planned, our kit, everything would have been right. Our mapping was right. You know, the teams that finished were like, yeah, you guys, the maps that you showed up, it kind of just, we had done everything right. Then we got back and yeah, Skip took a bit longer than I did to come around to it, but we committed again to 2023.
Wow. Better prepared. And you ended up finishing in 2023. I don't know. You probably got a lot of the jitters out of the system.
Mate, to be honest, like I've never been so positively. So when we flew out this 2023, the feeling was so different. You know, we got there. It was exciting to see the river again. It wasn't as high, so it didn't look as scary. But to be honest, it was amazing. We both could not wait to get on that river.
Yeah.
And our good friends, Glenn and Maureen, who lent us the truck, drove. They did an 11,000 kilometer round trip. From Ontario, they drove to Whitehorse, they met us there, and it's an unsupported race, so you can't have support, but they met us there just to help us the week before with logistics. You know, they took our balls to the start line, they made sure all our kit was ready for the start, but then they also then drove and met us at the finish line like we had done for them, so they could drive us back to the start again. They were there in spirit. They just wanted to see us complete this adventure as well, and there was a massive feeling of we were being followed by all the people that we should have been there with in 2022. There was this whole, you just felt this whole kind of wave of support around the world for us to go out and do it. So on the start line, there was this very, very, I'm not a religious spirit, but it was just something very special. And it's like, I can remember just all the senses, the spider senses were tingling and, you know, the noise, the smell. Glenn, for sort of First Nations, he gave a First Nation blessing. And I remember we got on the water. Heidi, a canoeist who did it in 2022, who we got good friends with, she met us there as well. She was she gave us these little bracelets with Sisu, S-I-S-U. If you look it up, it's a fantastic thing about challenges and adversity. She gave us that on the start line. And the words there meant so much to me and Skip. And we just couldn't wait to get the paddle wet, you know, and we had the blessing. 5 second countdown went. It's the most anticlimactic start to any race you'll ever see, because a 1,000 mile race isn't going to be won in the first 20 meters. Mm-hmm. So the whistle goes and you ponder your way down to the start line. You get on your board and you think, all you're thinking is, don't fall in now, Craig. You know, there's people watching, like, you know, that, it would just set you off on the wrong, you know, trajectory. You get on, get paddle out, you know, you can see the float, you're in like an eddy where you start, you paddle out, you get in the flow, And then you're like, we're doing this, man. You know, I remember skipping over, we're off, here we go. You know, and it was like a really like, this is it. You know, this is what these four or five, this has all been for this moment, and it's all been worth the wait. It's all been worth it. It happened for a reason, and we're now going to show, you know, we're now going to prove that this is why it happened. You know, this is why, wow, all those things. You know,
what is it, four years in the making?
Yeah, August 29th. Yeah, so it's 3 years, 11 months.
Jeez, you were ready.
We were more than ready.
What was different about Alaska from the river than from the road, and seeing what you saw there versus this time around?
I mean, everything. Yeah. I mean, when I say that, so you know, you get on the river, the first 30 kilometers, you know, you're meandering your way out of civilization, but there's civilization. You know, you're passing some canoes. You know, there's a few three little river plains. You get onto Lake Lebarge, which is, you know, there's a saying of, you know, in the river quest, make the lake, make the race. You know, it's a, I think, what, 60, 70 kilometer lake can have its own microclimate. You know, it can either have a nice little tailwind, but it can then kick up a storm with, you know, 3-4 foot waves coming at you cross shore. You know, so it's the biggest concern for the organizers. You know, they're like, well, it's one of the biggest concerns, not the, you have to stick to the right of the lake, because that's where if things go south, you can get off and at least wait it out, because you've got banks and stuff. The left-hand side is cliff faces. But we were very lucky. We got onto the lake. It was glass pretty much. You know, we had a very slight, you know, 2-mile-an-hour tailwind maybe. And you get onto that. We crossed that. I remember
What is it like when the lake narrows back down? It seems to happen very suddenly.
So that's the weirdest thing. So like, again, you've got your maps you've made, you've got your GPS watch. You know, I know I've seen this in my dreams over and over. So everything I saw was making sense. It was nothing. It was weird, a really weird feeling where it just looked like it was like I had it imprinted in my head. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, here we are. I know where we are now without even looking at a map. Oh, we're there. And later on in the river, going around corners, like, oh, I know where we are now. In the most, anyway, so you're crossing the lake and you're coming to the end of the lake, and I remember the entry back into the river is like, you're coming into the corner, and it's just a row of trees, and you're like, well, have we gone wrong? Like, where? And it's like, we're definitely at the end of the lake, because we can't carry on. And you know, I'm looking at you look at my GPS, and it's like, well, we're there. And you're like, where is it? And then you look at this tree line, and you just notice that there's a little just dimp, you know, there's like a little, like, just like little kind of like spit, and you kind of paddle over to it, and there's like a, I don't know, 5-6 meter, oh, maybe 10 meter wide entrance to this, like, and it's like, is that it? Is that the mighty Yukon that goes for 1,000 miles, wow, into the Bering Sea? You know, you turn into it, and then obviously there's no flow on the lake, so it's a real slog. You know, it was we did it when John, the organizer, was like, Craig, get across that in 12 and a half hours in total, from start to there. We did it in 11 and a quarter. So I knew that was a good sign, because we didn't have any benchmark of, you know, you don't know if you're doing good or not, because you don't know the conditions. But I remember John saying, get across it and get from start to the end of the lake in 12 and a half hours. And I, you know, like I said, we got across it in like 11, it's about 11 hours, 20, 11 and 20. And I was like, okay, we're good. This is good. This is a good sign. Mm-hmm. You get on. We hadn't seen the other sub team since the start. I promised myself not to pay any attention to the other teams. We ended up being in front off the start line, and I made a point of not being competitive and looking back. And we didn't look back until we got onto the lake, and we were like 10K into the lake, and on a perfectly clear day, and I couldn't see another dot. So, wow. So we knew we were out in front. We knew we had quite a good lead. You turn into the river flows, and it's the most beautiful part of the river. The smell of alpine forest.
Oh, that's what I miss the most, is the smell.
I mean, my family would say, I've been on searching for a candle that replicates that.
Okay, I've got one for you. I've got one for you. Juniper Ridge. I'll plug it here. Juniper Ridge is a company.
Amazing.
My wife bought me candles for Christmas, and it's all different pine trees and in areas in the American West. And I literally was smelling coastal pine this morning. So I'll plug in. But yeah, I look for that. That's what brings a tear to my eyes, the smell.
Absolutely.
You know?
And you're on this river, and I remember it's quite narrow there, so it's moving you're doing like, you know, 15, 16 kilometers an hour, and just the smells and the silence. You gotta remember, like, particularly me, but Skips, we're not adventurers. This is not like another adventure to our list. This is not like, oh, how does this compare to the time we, you know, walked from Peru to, you know, this is like, cool, this is a little bit different to that canal we paddled on in Guildford in Surrey, where we had to dodge shopping trolleys that were being chucked at us by kids on the bridge. You know, it's like we're doing this.
There's no reference.
No. And first night campsite, you know, we had a, like I said, campsite, you know, just wild. We got to midnight. We went as far close to the cutoff as we could, found probably one of the worst campsites we stayed on. It was just stones in like inch deep water. We managed to find a bit where there's enough sand to get the tents up. And this is a great comparison. Two Brits who have never had to do with wildlife. We're like, right. So we've pulled up our boards. We've made sure they're not going to float away. And we're standing there with bear spray each in one hand and a knife in the other. And yeah, exactly. And we're walking around and we're like looking for tracks and bear scat. And we're, oh, is that? And for those of you that may have not gone to the region, there's animal prints everywhere because they don't go until the ice comes. They just get less prominent. So actually, you get off on and you look at a sandbar and you're like, oh, there's prints. You know, that's a moose print. And then you see the size of a moose, you see how big a moose is, you know. Oh. They're probably, you know, they can walk through a tent and not know you're there. Then you start to realize that you have to learn that, like, is that fresh? Well, no, it's got sand in it. There's wind been blown into it. It's got soft edges. We were learning this on the fly. No one taught us this. So we didn't know how to find the flow on a river because we don't have flow like that in the UK. So we were learning on the job. You know, we were skilling up. Every kilometer on that river felt like we were adding more skills to our skill bucket. They're just learning how to read the river, where to paddle, you know, finding the flow, and then working out how did we fight. We had speedos on our boards. The best tip I could ever give is have a speedo in your eyesight, because when you're on a river, it's parts where you think, oh, I'm scooting along here, and you
have a speedo. Is like this cycle computer or something. Yeah, you can get a board.
Well, you can get a $10 one off Amazon, anything. But I had a Garmin Fortrex.
Yeah. It's not the small bathing suit speedos.
No, speed gauge. So day one, I think it took us about 20 minutes to decide the campsite was safe. By day six, I didn't even look for tracks. You know, it's like, unless there's a bear sitting there waving at us, I'm going to sleep. You know, it was, so seeing it from the river was just the smells, the sights, the lack of noise. The noise, we embraced it.
Wow. No vehicles, you know, no sound of vehicles.
Oh, nothing. No sound of vehicles, no people, no wow. Signs of life, no artificial light pollution. You know, the only sounds were me and my partner and his terrible singing.
So the sunsets must have been amazing because they were prolonged.
It just sits, it kind of just, particularly when you get further north, when you get up towards the Arctic Circle, it kind of just goes round.
Yeah.
And it goes behind like a mountain or a bit. So it goes, get cold in place, but it's still light. And unlike.
Yeah, but it doesn't get low enough to almost cause that sunset effect.
Really? No.
Yeah. Wow.
It's just like, it's just incredible, you know?
So I mean, this is just so you're learning this stuff on the fly. That's such a great life lesson. Like, there's so much you can learn just by doing.
Yep.
Was there anything that you'd say, I wish I would have done more preparation here? Or is it really just, hey, you can only do so much and then you just got to go for it? And there's just certain things you're just not going to know until you get out there.
Yeah, you don't know till you know. And that is the whole thing about adventures. You know, like, I will go into any more adventure, like, have I, you know, going in, risk assessment, making sure I'm happy and comfortable that I don't know everything now, but it will be okay. I know I've got the basic skills. There's nothing I wish we had done differently. And there's nothing I would, obviously, if I went and did it again, I would do things differently for a different experience, but there's nothing that made me think, I wish we did that. Everything just worked, you know. The agreement Skip and I had with each other, the best bit of advice I can give anyone, not just for the Yukon, but any kind of multi-day adventure, is the relationship you have with your partner or your team is what will make or break you and your chance of success in a race. We had this agreement that, like, if there's any niggles, if anything's bothering either of us, we just have it out in the open there and then. And it's not about the other person saying sorry or agreeing that you're right or trying to convince. It's just like, hey, man, this is bugging me. I'm really sorry about that. It's bugging me. And the other person, like, okay, cool. I understand it's bugging you. I won't. It's not about blaming someone. And there was many times, particularly with sleep deprivation. Now, by the end of the race, we were sleeping on average 2.5 hours a day.
Yeah.
The longest 2.5 hours on a sandbar, listening for animals. I'm paddling 18 hours a day in the world's most remote parts of the world.
And the reason you were sleeping so little is because all the prep of, like, yeah. You got on the shore, you got to make dinner, you got to set up camp. By the time you rest, relax, change clothes, do what you got to do, there was only a couple hours of sleep.
Yeah, you got to break camp. We did only thing we did in camp was sleep and poop. Everything else we did on the boards. We didn't even eat in camp. We ate on the boards. We did everything on the boards. We filtered our water on the boards. We had little lists of things. We made camp as quick as possible, put our heads down, set the alarm for 2.5 hours, get up. I usually get up before skip. I would get up, sort a few things out, then wake, then kind of give him a nudge. I needed like a bit of me time either side of going to bed and waking up before I got skipped. So I would get up and just start breaking stuff down and, you know, start boiling the water for the food for the day, then give Skip a nudge. He would get up. We'd load the boards up, and most days we were on the water waiting for the 6 hour timer to go off, standing there ready, you know, knee deep in water, and we very rarely missed our start time. And then we would 2 hours into the morning, we would kind of go to our knees, get the food out, eat while floating. You know, why eat in camp when you could eat while floating at 7 kilometers an hour? You know, yeah, that's how we
efficient. It's efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. And
10 years down the road from now, if someone asks, hey, tell me a story from that experience, what do you think one of the first stories you're going to point to from encapsulate what went on there and what you'll remember from it?
Wow.
I know. I've got a few, but it's like, even then, it's a list.
I wish that I had thought about, I mean, it's like, even now, I'm making a documentary about the race anyway, which, look in the show notes, I'm sure you'll link to it and you'll see stuff. So I'm reliving the race still daily by going through my footage and other teams' footage. So it's kind of very fresh in my mind. But I think in 10 years' time...
Because so folks know, you did this past summer. I mean, this is not, you know, 3-4 years. Sometimes we talk to people, the event was a while ago and they've written a book since and we're talking about the book. So they've had time to process it. You're still going through that process.
I still have no feeling in my toes.
that's legit. Like, it takes a while. It takes a while for stuff to come back.
The nerve damage, you know, I had no feeling in my feet for 6 months. What would I say? I mean, I have a thing about life that these kind of experiences, age, I don't look at age as a number, as like getting old. I look at age as a level. So in 10 years time, I would be 10 levels higher. And I'd like to think that in 10 levels higher, I'll be doing something just as amazing that is pushing me to do something that is well outside my comfort zone. I will look back on the Yukon 1000 as hopefully not the only life-changing experience that I'll ever go through. So I don't want to think that was it. That was my, I don't want that to be the thing. You know, that showed me that what you're capable of. And it showed me how, if you really do put your mind to something, you can come out of this, the life lessons and things. And I hope that inspires, you know, people to just, you know, go outside of and do something that they thought they would never, you know, in their wildest dreams going to do. And I hope in 10 years time, I look back and say, well, that was a start. That started me off doing this, and now I'm doing this. And when I'm 80, I want to be doing something that is pushing me based on what I'm doing when I'm 80, you know, which might be paddling down a canal in Guildford, dodging shopping trolleys being chucked to me by kids at school. Because when I'm 80, that's going to be quite an adventure. I don't know if that's an answer to the question. It's just like the taste for adventure is there now, you know. And like you said at the beginning of this 2017, I tore my knee, tore my MCL kite surfing, and spent maybe half an hour maximum on a paddleboard, and now done some probably done some of the most epic things you can do on a paddleboard in a short period of time. And it's a small niche community, really. It's a great growing community. So, you know, you are known, you get contacted quite a lot, people doing the 1000, people doing other races, you know. Mm-hmm. I did all my personal training diplomas and my coaching and my training. So like, I'm now helping teams and consulting teams that are doing this race and other races similar to it, passing on my experience, but not giving them a, here's a ready-made plan for how to do the Yukon 1000. I'm trying to tell people that, yes, you can go on and contact people and someone can send you their maps. Someone can send you their GPS track. Someone can send you their kit list telling you exactly what you need. Someone could tell you what the adventure is, that part. That is the adventure. That is the part that is so special, the learning. And so I'm helping other teams by saying, look, you know, I'll tell you some shortcuts. You know, to do your mapping, here's some great websites to look at. These are the books I would recommend you read. You know, like, here's a good place to hire a canoe from, because, you know, that's just practical stuff. That's just, spend time learning this, spend time doing this. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I will hopefully give you enough to inspire you to go out and make your own journey and do it your own way.
When should we expect a film to come out?
So that is the next ultra endurance event that seems to be going on forever.
That's usually harder than the
adventure. I mean, yeah, it is, because, you know, my full-time occupation, I have a film production company. I always, what they say, everyone's got a book in them. I don't like writing, so I'd like to think that everyone's got a film in them. So this is my documentary, my film. It's kind of, I'm doing it myself. I would like it out by spring. I'd like it out before the 2024 race. It's a beast of a project, because I have my attention to detail. I want to tell the story in the right way. And it's not the thing about the film. The film is not about me or Skip or our adventure. It's about the race, the people, both past and present, and the 2023 race. So I'm hoping to cover something in there that will appeal to everyone, whether you canoe, you paddleboard, you kayak, or you do none of the above. And you're just interested in some crazy people chucking themselves down a river and hoping they pop out 1,000 miles down the river with nothing but a bit of suntan, some mosquito bites, and an amazing Yukon 1000 coin.
Wow, man. I mean, I can't think of a more adventurous thing to do than 1,000 miles on a paddleboard in Alaska. Can I ask this before we get off?
And yeah.
What was one of the wildest reactions you had to somebody seeing you do this? Because, I mean, if I was on the Yukon River in a village and saw two dudes going by me on a paddleboard, I don't know what I would have thought. Did you have any interactions like that, or you just didn't see anybody?
Didn't see anyone. You know, so like, this is so beautiful to not see anyone. It was amazing. You know, so the hardest thing was trying to maybe explain to people back home what we were doing was hard enough. When we'd done it, there's a horrible, I think probably the post race blues I've never had anything like it, because, you know,
I guarantee you had it after this.
Yeah. Oh,
big
get
time.
Back and the noise, people, cars, your senses are hyper aware, and you almost want to shout at people and say, do you know where I've just been and what I've just done? Not for recognition, but because things that you thought mattered don't really matter. And I like to, I hope that I've come back. The things I hope to take away from the race is that the things I learned on the race about what matters most, what doesn't matter, what I could throw away, what I should not get stressed about, you know, that like what's not going to matter in 10 years time, it's not what to worry about. I'd like to think that, you know, 6 months out from the race, I'm living by those virtues and those new kind of like life parameters I've kind of set myself now. You know, I'm a very different, I'm nowhere near as stressed as I used to be. I look at things and it's something that would normally stress me out. I'm like, does it really matter? You know, the great quote is like, did I die? Am I going to die? No, I'm not. Does it matter? Is this going to matter in a week's time? No, it's not. You know, like, so I, you know, trying to explain to people what it's like out there. Someone said to me, this shows you how it's hard sometimes for people to comprehend what you've done. Someone's like, so you did 1,000 miles in 10 days. How did you know what hotels to book each night if you didn't know how far you would travel each day? And you're just like, you don't quite get what I mean by no one's up there, do you? And like, you don't want to say to someone that makes it sound silly, because, you know, you don't want, you know, it just makes you realize how people just can't, in the world, the crazy world we live in, you know, the crazy, hectic, busy, some people's perception of what is off the face of the earth is, oh, I drove out of town the other day and I passed a tractor. You know, that to them is like, oh, I went for a walk and I saw only four dog walkers. It must be a horrible day. They don't quite understand that, like, what it means to say, I did not see a human being. I saw more bears than humans. I drank and purified all my water. I only ate what I had on my board. My feet swelled to the size of hammers. I haven't had feeling in my feet for 6 months. My hands were falling apart. You know, I lost 7 kilograms in 9 days and I finished it with the biggest smile on my face. I could never expect anyone to really understand that. but we've all done it in our own ways, in our own adventures. And I think it's not about trying to convince someone how great it was. And that's why I hope the documentary, that's why maybe it's taking a bit longer, because I could make a very, oh, look, here's a really nice thing. Here's, but I want to try and show enough, but not everything. I want to kind of, hopefully, I want someone to watch it and maybe go, okay, the Yukon ain't for me, but hey, you know, I might go out and do that hike, or I might go and do that. And I might actually go and try that paddleboarding, or I might do that. Or I actually might contact Craig and say, okay, what do I need to do to get into the Yukon 1000? You know, I don't know, but I know that's another long-winded answer to a short question.
No, that's an amazing answer. That's you nailed so many things. I can't imagine how hard it was to readjust to normal life and care about bills and just those things that, you know, survival for 10 days literally is just taking it back to our lizard brain and letting that just flourish and be in control. Wow. We don't get the chance ever. Most people never get that chance to even do that for a moment, much less a week and a half and other things you've done since.
When was the last time in your life you could say, I only had to think about one thing, and that was just keeping myself and my partner alive? That was all we had to think about for 10 days. And it was the most liberating thing. All we cared about was making sure we were both safe. That was all we thought about. That's all we did.
It's almost like the only thing we can do now to take us back to the simplicity of childhood, of just having fun. Or it's not fun in the sense of just playing with your toys and playing with other friends, but it is simple in the same way. There's something about it that's just unbelievable. And man, so, you know, this film's coming up. Did I see that you're going to be doing some other races here soon?
I got back from the Yukon and I went and did the 11 cities in Holland a 6 weeks after. That's a 220 kilometer nonstop race in Holland. I tried it the year before and didn't quite make it. I scratched. I had terrible cramps.
How'd you do this year?
I finished it and I earned my cross. There's a 11 cities cross, which you have to finish it in under 34 hours. I had the most amazing support team, Ella, a good friend who did the Yukon in 2020, and Yannicka. She won the race. She won the 11 cities the year before. She's done it many times. She supported me. I got my 11 cities cross. I come eighth in that. That was a month and a half after doing the Yukon 1000. So I didn't get on a paddleboard from the Yukon. Got off, and the next paddleboard I got on was a 220 kilometer race. Put that one to bed. So basically ticked off. So like I was going through ticking off the things that I wanted to say, and then head out to Last Paddler Standing where we met. Mm-hmm. That was like my end of season. I signed up for that at the beginning of the year. So, and I know that we'd be here forever, so I'm not going to go into any details, but that race it was an endurance race, but it made me realize that not all endurance races are the same. I absolutely love the brutal simplicity of that race. I love what Greg's doing with the race, and I'm going to fully support it, but it wasn't the kind of race for me. I found out after a few hours.
But you found out a new skill, which is covering races like that, because you're not going to cover the Yukon. Like, it's just impossible. But this kind of event is watchable.
It turned out that, like, I can talk for 42 hours as well as paddle. So I still don't say I don't like the sound of my own voice, and I can't understand why someone stayed listening to me talk with you and Kristen. But, I had the most amazing time meeting some of the world's most amazing and inspirational paddlers. You know, I felt, you know, why, you know, this is amazing. Why am I here? And I've got people like John Nippers, like, oh, my God, it's the Craig Sawyer. You know, they're like, this is weird. This is just really,
and, you know, Bruce went and watched every minute of that live stream. He said he loved it, too.
You and I and Kristen and various guests talked for 42 hours, and I discovered that actually I love sharing the stoke and the enthusiasm around that. And I do hope that, you know, 2024, I get to take that passion and do more commentary and covering stuff, particularly around the ultra enduro. That element. I think I've hopefully proved myself to be a voice of not authorities, wrong it is, but you know, hope I've got enough interesting stuff to keep people listening, and people can deal with my English accent and my often very fast talking, and sometimes mouth goes before the brain engages. So I hope the Last Paddler Standing was amazing, and I hope that's opened some doors. And I didn't think I'd be racing, and I don't think this. I was on a paddleboard, but I hadn't put any stress on myself. But then, you know, someone's like, "Hey, so." You're doing the Alabama 650, right? And do you know what happened? What happened in August 2019 when Skip and I sat on that in that pub and looked up a race, and like I was about to say, I was like, oh, start Googling it. Like, yeah, I'm in the Alabama 650 this year, you know. So
I was going to say that might have come up as the longest annual paddleboard race at the time.
So that's the longest. It wasn't around then, but so this is the longest paddle. That's the longest American paddleboard race. So yeah, so I'm in for that in September. Very different race.
Oh yeah,
very different challenge. Not a team supported, but not, you know, on your own. Only two paddlers have ever completed it. Obviously, John and Brad. Brad Friesen from Canada, an absolute legend that has helped us. He's done the Yukon 1000 and helped me out immensely with his paddle partner, Scott. So yeah, so at the moment I'm down for the Alabama 650. I've now having to speak to people and convince myself that I don't need to be worried about crocodiles, snakes and bears and sharks. But that's a very different race. That's going to take a lot of training. That's going to take a lot of physical because there's no flow. You know, there's a lot. Brad even said that he thinks physically the 650 is harder than the 1000. From a physical point of view, I take his word. I don't like to compare. I think you can't compare races, but you just know you're going to find a pain cave somewhere and it's going to be mental, physical. When you get to these kind of races, you can't compare. But what you can compare is that you know you've had the ability, you've done it before, you've put yourself in a position of something that just seems completely impossible to do, and you did it. So why the hell not this time around?
Wow. You know. Well, Craig, I think we're going to have you back on to talk about some of this other stuff, especially because you're not done. And how do you find in this newfound passion and desire for these long trips fitting in with the normal life? Because that's often a question people have from like a practical point of view.
Yeah.
Because you have your own business, you have a family. These things are traveling pretty far. How do you do it?
Well, I've traveled for work. So as a film producer, yep. I've always traveled. So I've always, you know, before COVID, you know, I was in the US, you know, sometimes twice a month. So I've kind of had, so I've built the business and my team around me to enable me to do these things. I have actually set up a separate site as a side project. It's part of my company, but focused on creating adventure content. I've got a passion for something. I've got the experience through my company. So the Yukon documentary is the first one, but I have a project in mind of untold stories, creating short films about some amazing people and adventures, like what you're doing on the podcast, but for maybe film, you know, I want to go and see Nippers. I want to go and see John, you know, those that know his backstory. I mean, I want to be the one that gets that on film, you know, like,
well, we didn't get it on the podcast. We jumped right into that. I said, dang it, man. We never got around to doing it.
So
there's a lot more there.
There is a lot more. So I think we'll see, you know, I want to get more into creating content around, you know, combining the passion, my experience, but also going out these adventures. Time is always tough, you know, like it's a passion. You've got to fit in the training as well for if I'm doing the races as well, you know. This is something that, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you're just buzzing to get going, it's amazing. And I'm very fortunate to have hopefully put myself in a position that I can do these things and disappear off and have these adventures, you know, and hopefully do things that are going to surprise me every day.
Man, I'm super excited. And that's above66.co.uk, right?
Yeah, so above, and a little story on that one very quickly, for I know we've got to go, but above66.co.uk, above66, I mean, some people said, why? You know, so my main company is called Blue Juice. Blue Juice was a terrible 1990s surf film, a UK surf film that basically went straight to DVD, but has some quite big people in it. One of Ewan McGregor's first films, Catherine Zeta-Jones is in it. Look it up. It's called Blue Juice.
Okay.
That was my inspiration for my main production company, Blue Juice, because I love water at the time, you know, kite surfing. And above 66 is, well, the Arctic Circle is the 66th parallel. The Yukon 1000, I went for the first time ever above 66. I actually filmed myself crossing the Arctic Circle on the Yukon and declaring to my GoPro that the promise to myself is to start a production company called Above 66 that will focus on pure adventure content, sports, endurance, and the people within it. So that's where it was born. It was born as I crossed the 66th parallel into the Arctic Circle.
You made like a declaration.
I made a declaration.
No kidding. I did not know that.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I made a declaration. I've got the GoPro video of me saying it as I cross over the parallel. Set a website
cool,
up.
Man.
Yukon 1000 will be the first production I put out on it. Like I said, I'm calling it Untold Stories, you know, so I want to fill that bank of projects with short films. Nothing quite as meet the 1000. I don't think I've got enough storage and hard drive space to keep doing this, but you know, there's some amazing stories out there, some amazing people. So yeah, so above66.co.uk, Instagram, you know, above66. You can also find I've got the Sup Coach. I know you'll have all these in the links as well. So basically, I'm kind of like spread out and splattered all across social and in various places and stuff, and it shouldn't be too difficult to find me and hunt me down and haunt me.
There you go. Oh man, well Craig, thank you. Gosh, so much coming on, telling a little bit about it. I know there's literally books worth of stories you could tell. So yeah. Thanks for trying to summarize it and just inspiring folks, because this is, you went for it, man. And it shows that you can do it. And you had, I mean, that's a lot of setback you had too, and you still got it done. It really inspired, man. Really inspiring.
As we close out, Skip and I, without each other, it would never have happened. She's a partner, someone as strong as Skip. And I, we just had that, it just worked. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. And like, you know, we can both dine on that one for a long time to come.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Raw sugar, from hair care to body wash to lotions and more, is made with cold-pressed extracts from clean, good-for-you ingredients, delivering a raw clean that infuses your senses with raw joy. Raw sugar, available at your local Target.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.